so I don't want to take up too much time, but I wanted to thank everyone for coming. This is the Human Ecology Forum at the College of the Atlantic. And I've told this story before, but I got to tell it again real quickly, because it's not just because it's the go-to story, but because it tells, I think, a lot about Ashley. 2 years ago, I went out to visit Ashley on a Sunday, and I had to twist my girl's arms to go out there. You know, I have a 10-year-old and, at the time, 12-year-old girl, and I couldn't get them really excited about going out to an island. They're like, "Dad, we already live on the island. I don't want to go to another island." You know, typical 10 and 12-year-old thing. But we made it out there and spent the morning with Ashley, and Ashley was working with them. It was so felt so privileged. And my 12-year-old, halfway through the day, comes up to me and she pulls me aside. And I'm like, "What, Maggie, what?" And she said, "Dad, that man is inspirational." And she never used that word before. It was perfect. And I said, yes, indeed, he is. And he's a man that really needs no introduction here to MDI, but a very, very successful author of over 20 children's books, but that appeal to a 4-year-old and a 400-year-old, if that's possible. And this man is a center of gravity that I have to say really changed the way I look at the world. And that's what this college is all about, is trying to take young people and trying to give them a new perspective on life. And not that my old perspective was bad, but my new one is even better. And I'm so thankful for Ashley and his work and his relationship with the college. You have to go see the exhibit if you haven't. It's only up for another few weeks, but visit it and get to know us and get to know Ashley. And with that, thank you very much for coming, and thank you, Ashley, for coming.
Thank you. Come around and come and sit on the floor up front. Come around to this bottom door and sit on the floor up front, so you all can get in. If you, people in the back, come on up and sit on
go
the floor up front. We'll
on.
Wait for you to come in. Yeah, come on in through here and all along here. Just move right across. Come all the way across.
Move back.
Come on across.
You can move back.
Let's move
back. Yeah,
move
out of the way. Yeah.
Oh, but you're going to give a speech, aren't you?
Yeah, this is
okay. I'll put it like here. There's no room for you,
he's
Ashley.
He's memorized the speech. Yeah,
are you okay there? Okay.
Come on in. There's lots of room. Come on up front. Come on up front and sit down. And I'll stand.
Yay! Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, we want to fit you all in, old Mother Hubbard.
John, I don't know if we collect data, but this might be, I think this is the most well-attended Human Ecology Forum.
I think it's certainly the most people we've had in here. Thank you all for coming. I'm Drew Colbert. I'm going to be having a conversation along with you with Ashley today. I teach in the art area here and have been taking my classes out to see Ashley for a very long time. And I see Carol Shutt, and she's taken her class, her kids from the Northeast Harbor Elementary School, actually visited with Ashley today, right? But, you know, we're just a handful of people who have been taking students out to see Ashley for years and years and years now.
From the very beginning.
He's quite a good friend of ours. So, yes. And he spent the whole day in Take a Break today talking with students and
my
drinking
seventh grade
coffee.
Friend from the Northeast Harbor Elementary. Wonderful people. With Carol Schlitt.
So the format today is, as much as we tried to get Ashley to give a speech today, it wasn't going to happen. So, just kidding. No, we call it a visit with Ashley because we want you guys to let's have a conversation with him. So be thinking about compelling questions that you might, if you saw the show, if there's something you have a question about for Ashley, we'll just talk, okay?
Good.
And I'll start. I have a question.
You do what? First, I start with everyone,
He's gonna start.
See what I told you?
You have to begin with a poem, every program. So everybody repeating after me, a love of who you are and a love of your people, okay? My people!
My people!
By Langston Hughes!
By Langston Hughes!
The night is beautiful!
The night is beautiful!
So the faces of my people!
So the faces of my people!
Stars are beautiful.
The stars are beautiful.
So the eyes of my people.
So the eyes of my people.
Beautiful also is the sun.
Beautiful also is the sun.
Beautiful also are the souls of my people.
Beautiful also are the souls of my people.
That brings us all together.
It's, the question is, where did all this begin for you? Your art making and your interest in art making, did you start when you were a child, or did you? Yeah.
Well, that's a question of when. How did all this begin? Yeah. My love of drawing, of painting, of reading, all, it began before kindergarten, at home. My love of drawing, always drawing, my father bringing home papers from the print shop, so that I wouldn't just draw on the walls and on the sheets and on the tables and everything. He said, no, you draw on papers. So they gave me papers to draw. That's how it began. I never stopped doing that. And with my sister, there were six of us, four boys, two girls. I was the second of the six. And my sister and I worked together a lot in doing things and drawing and painting. And when we go for walks in the city, in the streets, in the Bronx, in New York City, we'd pick up things that people threw away. And then we'd make something out of it when we got home. We'd go to the commercial street and get those books of fabrics, you know, that the interior decorators. Oh, you should see the clothes we made, the vest, the dress, the quilt, out of cast-off stuff. So that, of picking up cast-off things, you'll see in the exhibit. You look at my puppets, shells, bones, driftwood, fisherman's gloves, a coconut. Things that you don't regard anymore because, yes, you'll pick up shells, you'll pick up driftwood, because we love to respond to them. I pick up one shell, then I pick up another shell. When I put them together, I said, that looks like a mask. So I took barnacles, I put an eye. I took a vertebrae, and that made the rest. And I had a person. And that person was alive to me then when I made the rest so that it could be a hand puppet, you see. And so I wanted to show my friends on the island that what we live with is alive. A touch of imagination, and you've opened up another way of seeing what you've been about. And it didn't matter, you'll see in the exhibit, if you've been there, you saw how I've taken the shell, the bone, the driftwood, the fisherman's gloves, the sea glass, and I've created hand puppets of them. But you see also how just the love of what's in the environment feeds into everything I do. Growing up in New York City, the Depression years of the 30s, you know, when my parents could feed, clothe, and house us, but they couldn't do any extra. But there were free WPA classes where the government hired artists and musicians. So we all went out to draw, to paint, to learn to play music. And we, you know, Depression years, they hired artists to work in the community. So that was wonderful. So.
Sorry.
Yeah, let's just get these lights right before.
You're working on lights?
Yes. We're working on the lights.
That's from my books of the spiritual, the Block Prince. And I love doing the Block Prince because those songs of black slaves are loved and sung throughout the world. And when I did these books over 40 years ago, I also cut, so the music would be like the medieval block printed books. And that's what I'm drawing for Richard Wright's book, Black Boy. But let's hold off on the slides for a while, because let's get going with what we're about, and then we'll follow slides later.
So, can I ask another question?
You're
gonna, or am I cut off?
Oh, okay.
So
she's a good question.
How did, so you had this start when you were 9 or 8 or whatever,
yeah,
the age of first
early years.
And then how did you persist as an artist? How did you make a life as an artist, a living as an artist, because I think a lot of our students wonder that. I mean, not maybe not just being an artist, but a scientist or whatever. How'd you do that? How did you carve out a path?
It's a very direct, simple question, really. Turn on the lights. Forget this. Forget this for a while. At the end, we'll go through slides. But let me see you all. The question is, how does one persist in something you love to do? You only persist by overcoming obstacles. There's not one of you who anything you wanted to realize is just came to you easily. You are sometimes meeting with great obstacles. How do I get from second to third grade? Something is challenged in me now. It's hard, but only by meeting that challenge will I move on and on. The thing is that when you meet the challenges, that's how you grow. Now, in the last thing I was talking about, I graduated high school. I was 16 when I graduated. In New York City at that time, it was strong public schools. All my teachers were white from kindergarten through high school in the Bronx where I grew up. They all encouraged me in art. They gave me papers and art materials. When I graduated high school, I had a portfolio. I needed a scholarship, 6 children in the family. I want to go on to college and study art. How do you do that? You got to get a scholarship. So I go out. Now, when I told the audience before, when I took my work to these colleges, the art school, they said, this is the best portfolio we have seen. But it would be a waste to give a scholarship to a colored person. Now, that's 1940, New York City. I'm not talking about Alabama, Mississippi, or Georgia. New York City, that's what I was told. Well, when I said that, I didn't want you to feel, isn't that awful? I wanted you to ask the question, if you were in a position at one of those colleges that a black person came with a portfolio, and you knew at the time the feeling about giving a scholarship to a black person, would you have stood up to that person and given him or her a chance? That's what I mean by, not that I just, oh, those are awful people, he didn't give them a chance. What I have accomplished, I don't want you to put down the people who resisted me at those times, because I didn't feel that way about it. I just said, I am going to find a way. I was fortunate, my high school teachers, when I came back, I graduated in January at 16, and they said, Ashley, come back and help us with the yearbook and do any classes you like. In the summer, take the exam for the Cooper Union School of Art and Engineering, take the art class. They do not see you there. Ha! The exam in 1940 was, you bring a bar of plasticine clay, you did an exercise in sculpture, you did an exercise in drawing, you did an exercise in architecture. And when you finish, you put them on the tray, and you put them on the platform of the Great Hall. And there they were. The next day, the professors came down. All you had was your name and the information about who you were. And the professors chose those students for the college. Now, I was fortunate in being one of those chosen. I was the only black in my class. But that wasn't so unusual because blacks were being discouraged. Even in elementary, junior, and high school, many blacks were being told, go into industrial classes and that, and don't stay in academics and things like that. So it was quite natural there wouldn't be many blacks applying for something, which, how are you going to make a living? You're going into art. Never occurred to me. I only wanted to become a person in that sense of human ecology, which is persisting in doing something that is meaningful to you, that will help you grow. It's not going to hurt another, so you don't let anyone or anything stop you. So that was the point I was trying to make. When they said it would be a waste, I don't hold that against them. I just say, I don't have any anger about that. I just feel that was their job. They were putting their jobs on the line if they took me. Would you do that? Would you be willing to put your job on the line when that was supporting your family and your rent and your food and everything? So you got to think of it in those terms. What was happening at the time? And ask yourself, how would I act? Because there are always people under slavery in all times who did not accept it. And they paid the price of being abolitionists or helping runaways or whatever. But you have a system that enforces your job, your family will be threatened if you accept me into your home as your friend, or walk with me, or give me a chance to learn to read. All right, because it was a crime to teach me, you see. So you have to see it in a broader context. What does human ecology mean? It means someone is hungry and you brought something for the person to eat. That's human ecology. You reached out to help another. You can't go deeper than that. You don't have to look for any refined definition. You can put up all the graphs and charts and things you like, and how art is way down and they don't consider art at the bottom of this. But that's not what it means. It simply means you're living it every day and moment of your life. Don't wait for a chance. In some of the letters, I got a sheaf of letters from students when I wrote for it. Very personal things. One of them says, I do not know, you have so much love and you have happiness. I don't know love, I don't know happiness. What are they talking about when they can say something like that, if right there in that cafeteria, they may know somebody who needs help in getting a seat and help that person to sit down? That's the ecology. The caring is the love and the happiness in doing something that was needed. You don't have to look for it outside. Yes, there's the romance and all the other things our heads are filled with, but in your daily doing of what is needed to help another, or being kind and thoughtful, the whole sense of what we mean by that, what the College Atlantic students work for in a situation where they can create a community of understanding and feeling and outreach. So no student need be isolated. It doesn't matter how close you are one to another, you're not going to be in a group that's going to exclude the others. Yes, you have someone you're very close to, but you're including others. You see someone who may be quite sitting aside and lonely, you don't know, but they're sitting aside, you ask them, why is that person always sitting aside at lunchtime? Let me go and sit next to that person. That's ecology. No. Just that gesture of opening yourself to the feelings of others, that is human. Now that all ties up with yesterday, Martin Luther King Day. That step in democracy that was taken in the civil rights time. People were trained nonviolent. I mean, how can you do love and nonviolence to change anything? So what did they do? They took the training of people beating on you, spitting on you, pulling the chairs under you, calling you names, how to curl up when being beaten. I'm not talking about just black people. The issue was about black people. But the whole nation of people of all backgrounds took a stand. That is injustice. We don't want that. We will pay the price. I'm always aware of the young people who lost their lives at that time because they couldn't accept that, you see. I never forget that. I don't go people because of police brutality. Oh, we haven't, nothing has changed, it's the same. I'll never forget the lives of the young people and elders of our country who stood up for what democracy means. It means ecology. That's what democracy means, giving people a chance to realize his or her potential, you see. And so that's the way in which I've seen these things, that no matter what would happen, in a nonviolent taking of it, in an exuding of love, you're trying to teach that other, I don't want to be like that. I don't know how you were as a child, but I don't see how you could come to growth and want to beat me up and stick a dog on me and the hoses and the tear gas and all of that, you see. But when you take that stand, it's a difficult one to take, but people did. And it's changed the course. It took another step in what we mean by democracy, which means trying to realize a world in which you have a chance, that everyone has an equal chance, you know, to realize his or her potential. So it's in that spirit of, that's why when they say human ecology, art and human ecology, and I say, help, help, you know, what am I going to say? It's very much there, everything you do. When a student takes that paper in the class, and they touch it with a line for a drawing or a word for a composition, that's human ecology. Because they're challenging a blank space or a blank screen, they're making a mark in it, and they're going to develop and build that to create something out of nothing, or create something out of all they've been absorbing and give it as something else, something of themselves. Yes, my friend?
You spoke a little bit this morning with my students about how the main landscape feeds you and heals you, and, you know, it even had a, you know, I'd love you to talk more about that. Yeah.
I was with Carol's seventh grade students from the Northeast Harbor Elementary School. They're wonderful people, and they have a great program in the Arts Week also. But they asked me about that question, which was...
Well, you talked about coming after the war, coming, you know, majoring in philosophy, trying to ask the questions of why does war happen, you know, just grappling with all that, and really no questions were answered for you until you came to Maine and just... Yeah.
Well, I think most of you know something of the experience of veterans coming home from wars. The tremendous psychological impact of their experiences and how they try to become normal when they get home. And they do succeed, but there's a great number of them who fall through. When they say a third of our homeless population are veterans, it tells the story. We don't have enough services to follow up the psychological upsets that they have, you see. And often, if you don't have strong family and friends and a direction behind you, it's very hard to just go after the tragedies you've experienced. I was drafted at 19, in my third year at college, okay, into a port battalion of stevedores in a segregated army, okay? We were people who worked on the docks, working with all the equipment that it takes to back up an army. So that was what we were doing through that time. I came home after the tragedies of the invasion and going beyond and seeing the destroyed cities in France, where I was after the coast of Normandy and Omaha Beach, and you know, then going after unloaded the ships, the Liberty ships, in the fall when they closed that beach down and the supplies are no longer coming. It was the amphibious dock that had been invented, that was a boat in the water and a truck on land, because Rommel never believed that you could land an army on a shore. They had mined the shores thoroughly, in the water and the shores. That's why if you've seen films, that you see the tremendous loss of life as people were pushing past. But they did gain a foothold and go past. We unloaded our cargo of the tanks, of the food, the clothes, of the ammunition, all the things that would back up an advancing army. And then we went ashore and dug foxholes, sometimes digging into mines, walking on mines, okay? But the thing was, we would go back every day and take another Liberty, there were hundreds of Liberty ships in that fleet, to unload the cargo because the army was making progress, going forward to the liberation of Paris finally. And we worked that. Now, when I came home, I was completely spun around. But I did know I wanted to complete my work at Cooper Union. But I said, why does man choose war? I want answers. I said, if I go back to school and study philosophy, I'm going to get answers. You see how naive I am? So there I am now. I'm an artist. If I'm going to study philosophy, I mean, I can't draw a drawing here. But what had happened when I came back to the Cooper Union, it was the very first year that the Skowhegan School of Art was founded in central Maine near Waterville, and it was on Lake Wessarunset near the Summerstock Theater there in all. Here I come out of the war, out of New York, the earth, the sky, the sea, and I'm to paint. That was the route that kept me going. So summers, I would come here because that first year at Skowhegan, we'd come to Acadia National Park. We'd see all these islands, and we asked the Maine students, can you find a place for us on one of these islands? That's how I came to the Cranberry Isles. I started on Great Cranberry, in the mid-50s, moved over to Little Cranberry. Okay, now, I would work through philosophy during this school year. In summer, I was painting outdoors in Maine. Back to it, when I completed the undergraduate work in philosophy, I said, I've got to face what it is to have a brush in my hand, a pencil, a pen. What is it in me that needs to discover myself through art? I have no sense of what that would be other than that I had to do it. So I got on a boat and I left for France. And I said, I'm going to use my GI Bill where I'm supported. And instead of the 2 8-hour days, one to earn your bread, the other keep growing as an artist, I can get 16 hours a day to just trying to find out what drawing and painting meant to me. In 1950, on the boat over to France, Aix-en-Provence, the Cézanne countryside, and I was painting. But it was the first year that Pablo Casals, the great cellist, the greatest instrumentalist of his time, who had refused to concertize after the Second World War because he said the Allies had abetted Franco in overturning the People's Revolution. And he was living in exile in Prades, a small community of Catalan speaking. He had grown up with the Catalan language, and Barcelona was just across the border. But he was living in exile, refusing to perform. It was the 250th anniversary of the death of Bach. And great musicians knew Bach was his heart. So they went to Pablo Casals and they said, will you perform honoring Bach? And he said, if you come to this town and play with me here, I will break my silence. And there was a cathedral in that town, nothing else, little houses, no hotels or anything, just. But in those early days, they built a big cathedral, a little house, a cloisters, a Saint Michel de Cuxa. But I went to that, and that's what brought that also. With Maine, and then the rhythm of my hand as I watched musicians performing in rehearsals, I was hidden from them in the cloisters. I would draw musicians. And then when I went back to my studio in Aix-en-Provence, I started painting musicians playing. My hand would just move. That rhythm in my hand is what I am after as an artist. It doesn't matter if I'm doing a painting of a landscape, of a musician, of a person, doing a book illustration. So it's the rhythm of the hand that I have the confidence in that's going to reveal something about me that I do not know. And I'm going to discover it only by the act of performing now. And that's how it opened up. But it was through that scholarship that everything opened up for me about Maine and painting outdoors. Every summer after that, when I was in the United States, I would be in Maine. When I had sabbatical, I was on the Cranberry Isles. And by that time, I had known the community in a way in which they were all to me family. And so you see, when I came to the island, to the Cranberry Isles, and I had my boxed in packages, I was getting off the boat with my box of material things, and I passed it. I had it, called it. Someone took it from me, and they passed it to another person, and that person passed it to another until it got up on the deck. I said, oh, it's just like the tenement apartment house in the Bronx where I live, where you know everybody, and everybody's hand reaches out to help the other. I was immediately at home. It had nothing to do with there are less than 1% of black people in the state of Maine. There were people who had a heart and a feeling who had community. And I feel if you don't create community, you're lacking, you're missing what we're put on earth to do, wherever we are, to create the sense of community that people are not left out. It hasn't to do whether you like them or not. But if there's any need, you're going to help, you see. And so that was important to me. That I found that on the island. And then when I moved over to Little Cranberry or Islesford, same thing. So when I was leaving Dartmouth in the late 80s, I was not going back to New York City, as much as I love the city. But it was the island, the earth, the sky, the sea, that we are put on earth to care for the elements that nature has given us as a gift. I mean, it's right there to celebrate. And that's what I mean by when we speak of human ecology and you're speaking of your pursuits, you must realize that what we mean by love and happiness are interrelated to just our daily experiences. There are special things we see. And remember, people have said, oh, you're so optimistic, you're so organized. Everything you do that you want to project comes from a base of understanding of what is suffering, what is pain. All through the years, I'm in my 90s, I've lost my mother, I've lost my father, I've lost my sister, I've lost my brother. Lord, at the base of everything I give up, facing the day with joy, has to do with what they have given me. They didn't want me to mourn their passing. They wanted me to go on as a creative person, offering the best I had in any situation to whoever was there, you see. So that's what I mean by overcoming an obstacle, the desire to know that if you're working to give your best, that's all you can do, you know. If at the end of the day you say, I've done my best, doesn't matter what anybody else thinks or says about what you've done, you're gonna feel that you've realized something in that day. It's meant something. You've made something of it. Thanks for asking that about after the war. It's very difficult. We have that problem today of working with the medically and all. There just isn't enough services to meet the need.
Actually, the other thing that I think what you just alluded to, you're talking about the way you spend your days.
Yes.
And I think, you know, part of the reason that you inspire me so is the way that you spend your days in such an engaged way. And I think that I would just love to hear you tell us a typical day of Ashley Bryan's life. How does that break down?
A typical day goes with any of you visiting whenever you like. You're never interrupting. You're really helping me create by being with me, because I feel your time is as valuable to you as my time is to me, so you never can take my time. It's the one thing that I can only offer. You cannot take it. And so whenever you never feel you're interrupting, I am using, right now I am drawing, I am painting. As I look around, all kinds of compositional ideas and color ideas, I never stop. So I mean, it's all, that's the way I've trained myself. Now I have friends who would say, between 5 and 8, don't come near me, I'm working. And you respect that. But I grew up in a family with so many around us. I was always pushed to the side to my little desk, you know, while everything else, they were dancing all the popular songs and carrying on. And I just found a way, what I have to realize in this life, no excuses. When I get to the gates of St. Peter and I say, you know, oh, I couldn't do it because Mr. Darren invited me to come and talk to people. Because, well, I mean, that meant coming off the island, I couldn't do that. Or my friend Carol was visiting, or Barbara, my friend from the Cape Rosia, was there, and so we had to talk about things, and I couldn't. No. Same people said, listen, you had more than enough time to do what you did. You can go to hell now. No excuses, children. And when I, you know, through the years, and there's a wonderful friend, a minister, Doug, that's here, who would give his talks, and I'd often miss something that he was saying, but he would allow me to go up on the stage and take his talk, and I could go over it because he could put together what I felt was what you try, what they call faith. You're always struggling, you don't know. But I always feel if I'm in the communion of others, there are others who have it. And so if I'm not getting it, they're getting it. So it helped me just by being with people who get it. I don't have to. As long as you're getting, I'm going to be there for communion, and you're being there with what you helps me. And so in that way, you know, you're always struggling to understand that. But the way my friend Douglas here would get those down, he would do a sermon and say, someone is being buried. It's a funeral service. And in it is a phrase in the Bible that no man comes to the Father except by me. So he looks out and says, the whole group of my Jewish friends here. And I don't want them to feel that Christianity is an exclusive club. Where's Jacob and Isaac and Moses and all these others? They can't fit in. So he deals directly with something. We just take his, yes, we believe it. But he opens it up so you'll think more deeply about it. And that's what any of our faiths mean. It means trying to understand what is inexplicable, not understandable in terms of intelligence or words or meaning, but somehow it comes through to you that it has a force that will direct your life, that you're not going to exclude anyone from a privilege because of any other name that you may give them, that you're taking it all in to make that community of what a believer is, you know. And you're not going to be like those who are closing others out because they are not like you, you know. You want as much variety of feeling and personality as you can find in your experiences in life as you go. Yes, my friend?
You said upstairs, every person is an artist.
Yes.
And so you taught art at Dartmouth.
Yes.
And I would just like to hear you elaborate a little bit. Does it get taught, really? Did you feel like the art in you was taught to you or nourished by art teachers?
Yeah, I was fortunate in that way. I have good teachers. They explained to me in college. A professor sat with us after I'd been in, come out of high school. I'm doing all kinds of artwork, costume design, stage design, graphic things and all that. I found and feel all I want to do is draw and paint out of myself, what they call the fine arts, and hope that you would like it also, but whether you liked it or not, that's what I was going to do. But the professor sat with us, not to scare us, and he said, listen, there are areas of the arts you make a good living, but if you're working in the fine arts, you're painting, you're composing music, you're doing choreography, you're writing poetry, you're writing novels, you're doing plays. All of these areas, he said, prepare yourself for 2 8-hour days. One, to earn your bread. The other, to keep growing as an artist. Now, he did not mean that literally. He meant simply, find a way to keep your hand in that no matter what your work in teaching and other areas are doing, you're going to find a way. So you have a little sketch pad, you draw an apple on the table before the day ends. You don't lose that touch. And so that meant everything to me. Now, when I said that the artist is not a special kind of person, every person is a special kind of artist. 20% of the people are these fine artists. They're doing the painting, the sculpture, the architecture. They're doing the choreography. They're writing music. They're writing plays. But they are working with that aesthetic in themselves, which is so deep with their hours of practice a day, that when that pianist is giving a concert, 80% of the people have that aesthetic in them and need to be fed with that art that that person is given. So the artisan people, which is the aesthetic, those 80%, they would not compose if there were not other people other than the artist who were open to what they're trying to get across. So you go to a concert now. It's a pianist, a great pianist is playing. How many people in that audience are playing the piano? But the aesthetic in them is being fed by the practice that artists have given to what he or she is sharing. You go to a museum. There are artists who have given hours and lives in doing painting and sculpture and architecture, in doing all kinds of forms of weaving and basket making, all of these things. How many people in the museum are doing practicing art? They are going because the aesthetic in them needs to be fed by those who give their lives and hours of practice to keeping you going, you see. In New York, there's an exhibit of Matisse's cutouts, okay? Now, there was a time when he couldn't hold the brush to paint. What did he do? He could hold the scissor and cut out forms. He could have assistants hold it up against the wall. He'd have a long stick, yes, put it in that place, and they would attach it to the paper or to the cloth, whatever was holding it up. Now, he went on cutting forms, and he made things which were very large, you know, cut out forms when he could no longer hold the brush for his painting. But he developed a way of cutting out papers and created a whole rich art of forms in that way. When you go to that exhibit, which has been so popular, when it opened at the Tate, they had to keep it open to in the night and for days beyond it. They've done the same thing at the Modern Museum. Isn't that right, Henry? They've opened it for a month longer to keep going on. Because when people walk in that show and they see the beautiful shapes and forms, they all start smiling. They're laughing at each other. They're having a good time. It's just what he wanted. He wanted to open up that touch of delight and spirit in you. And that's his direction, and he opened it. There are other reasons why artists will do their work. If you go to the Goya show, which is in Boston, ha! You see his drawings of the disasters of the war, his etchings and his paintings and things. It's But what does art mean? Art explains why we are alive and can take a thing like a war, or how we can take a thing of the disasters and the horrors. People are writing them. Dostoevsky wrote tremendous stories of the psychological derangements of people. Tolstoy wrote his War and Peace. They made beautiful works of the most horrible things in real life, you see. So you say to yourself, we are here to be able to bear and endure what we know is also difficult to take. But art allows us, you could look at one of those, that's a fantastic drawing, you see. You go to a museum, so many paintings of the stories of the Bible are not easy to take. They're not, I mean, to look at a person on a cross, I mean, and say that is, that you're, and you carry on about what a fantastic painting that is, you know. There is a dimension in the arts that we all have where we accept conventions and we live by those conventions. I say, you can go to a museum of portraits and they'll be cut off at the shoulder, heads. If you went into a room and saw people's heads sitting on a table, you couldn't accept that. Why is it the convention of art making you cut off somebody like that and accept that and say it's a beautiful painting? We are making conventions to make life supportable so we can endure the difficult. So when someone says to me, you know, about everyone is the artist, you know, it's not a special kind of person, I mean just that. The aesthetic in you is transforming the impossible to make it bearable, because that's what art does, you know. We know that the flowers I paint are going to wither and die, but I've caught it at a moment when I wanted to. If my friend Henry paints a landscape, it's going to change, it's going to go. But you want it to endure in a way that you can keep contemplating it, you see. It's that way. And my friend Barbara can work with her gardens in Camp Rozier or so, and the flowers are going to go. But it's the bringing to life of all of those that is so vital and exciting for us in life, to be able to endure. So when people say, oh, you're such a happy person, they don't understand. Yes, that's what I want to project. But don't forget what it comes through. It comes through being denied when I was growing. I could just stay with that. But that only allows me to be excited in realizing what was important to me, despite the odds, you see. And as I say, there's none of us here who has arrived at anything of learning or creating a family or something that you're caught up in that is not working against the odds. And you persist because it's meaningful to you. I don't know how much I've answered any questions. It's really so deep.
We have a question up here.
Anyone has a question?
Right here.
Can you call it out?
Yes, so? I will. If I have to repeat it.
No, my question is, you know, if everybody who visits your house encounters thousands of little active toys, and the question is, what role do they play in your life? Why did they start? Why have they kept on? How does this connect to a life of art?
What role do the toys and the objects that you've collected in your home, what role do they play in your creation?
It's a spirit of delight. I want when you enter my house, you'll smile. As Matisse would like, as you enter the exhibit, you'll smile. Because I've come out of academic situations where there's a lot going on, and sometimes it's pretty difficult. Do you know one day I'm going to slip away from this noisy circle? Because it seems like that would go, and I remember the poetry of Rilke, where he has that sentence, and I learned it in English. And then when I was in Germany, I learned it in German, because although I could translate the feeling, I couldn't translate the sound, but the feeling lived with me, these meetings. And I said, do you know, one day I'll slip away from this noisy circle. When I first see the star blooming above the oak tree, I will choose paths that were seldom trod in the pale evening meadows. And there's no dream like this. You will go with me. Ha! Oh, I didn't have to know German to love it. When I was in Germany, then weißt du, ich will mich schleichen leise auf lautem Kreis, wenn es erst die bleichen Sterne über den Eichen blühen weiß. You hear those I sounds? We couldn't translate them. Do you know? I'll slip away from the noisy circle. And then the E sounds in Wege will ich erkiesen, die selten wer betritt, in blasen Abendwiesen, und keinen Trauma als diesen, du gehst mit. Those E sounds you can't, but the feeling, and a pale evening, but there's no dream like this, you go with me. So it was working to pick up the sound of a language when I had that chance. So the poems that I loved in English, I have them in my head in German. I've lost conversational German from the late 50s when I was there. Not a poem in German is out of my head.
Wow.
The poems stay. So that was it. But now, so when people enter my house, I want that spirit of delight to hit you first. If any of you are doing any research in my house, it's not to be a job, it's not to be a struggle. I want when you walk in, you smile. Oh. Oh, wow. I'm to do something about the history of tin toys. As you turn around, you wind it up and you see how it moves around and wiggles. And you get into your research and your writing about it. But the spirit of delight to inform whatever you are about. And then, when the children would ask me, is it hard to do? When, you know, about my painting and my books in the elementary school, is that hard to do? I say, oh, it's the hardest thing in the world to do a writing for a story, to do the pictures for a story. Oh, I sometimes think I'd rather be digging ditches. I know I'm so wild. But I said, if you learn to put together having fun with working hard, there's no obstacle you will not overcome. There's no obstacle from which you will not learn. For even if you do not succeed, you'll have learned something from it, and you'll take a way to still go beyond and not be stopped. So if you can put together working hard with having fun. So I gave them this fellow, he's on the swimming team. Every morning the coach comes and knocks at 6 o'clock to wake him up. School doesn't begin till 8 or 9, but they knock at 6 o'clock. Come on, gotta do the practice swimming. Oh, he drags out. So the coach comes, knocks the door. Day after day, the coach comes knocking up. One day, the coach comes and knocks and opens, the guy is gone. He's taking it upon himself to develop, because now the desire to be a good swimmer has meant so much to him that you don't have to call me to go do it. Yeah, it's hard to get up early at 6 when I don't have to get up till 8 if I'm gonna go to class at 9. But he's taking it on him or herself. And now, it has a whole other meaning, you see. So when you've put together the desire that overcomes the difficulty of what you're facing with a sense of joy in realizing it, that's what makes it, you see. So you see, Dick, when you enter my house, that's the spirit that I hope pervades and that is never lost. And the interesting thing is, in working with a feeling of an Ashley Bryan Center, which is very touching, that people in my lifetime, they set up a show that you don't see until after you're gone. You're either looking down to it from heaven or up to it from hell. It doesn't happen in your lifetime. You don't get things of when you're a baby up to the present. You get maybe a retrospective of your work or something, but you don't get something like the show up there. How did it come about? Not from me. It came about from people I love, family and friends, who said, we would like to extend the outreach of your work in art and education. Could we work toward a center to keep that going? And that's how this has come about, you see. And that has meant, it's a very humbling experience for me to go up and see what went into that. With Drew working on the design, with Betts and others, with Josh helping to get things realized and worked out. The thousands of dollars that it cost to put that up, but they all took it on. And they went to our designers and said, in the fall, you have 6 months. And you said, Julian, that said, what do you mean 6 months? A commission like that, we take 2 or 3 years to do an exhibit like that for the research and all that goes into it. what we needed for this summer at the Oxford Historical, they didn't know from nothing. So that's how they got it worked out. So they had it in place in summertime. They really worked there. It means so much to me that people would have felt that and would get such an exhibit up that is about what I love to do. And as I said to my friends upstairs, I said, I hope you feel this exhibit is also about you. As I said to one of the friends up there, I said, look, you're excited that I take some shells or driftwood or a coconut and I create something. I said, you're given some potatoes, a pasta, and a vegetable. That's not a dinner. If you don't transform those the way I've transformed those shells, you don't have a dinner. We're always transforming, moving things from one state to another, all over the world, in different ways. You get some cloth. That's not a shirt or a dress. You just have cloth. You have to do something that the aesthetic in you to shape it and make it into something else. You're transforming something that's in one form. We are all transformers throughout the world, in one way or another, what's before us, making something other than what it is before us. And that's how we live each day, by transforming endless elements without thinking about them. That is what I call the artist is not a special kind of person, but every person is a special kind of artist. In all the ways in which you're working is how I'd like you to relate to me. If you see me as different, as other than you, when you see my show, you're missing what I hope you're getting out of it. I hope you're getting out of it something of yourself, as you see how I've involved myself in what I love to do, and you are thinking of something that you love to do, or something that you haven't done. Some of the letters from my friends said, you know, I've started picking up my guitar. I hadn't been playing it. Or I played this instrument, but I'm no good. I haven't practiced. I'm now practicing it. All those ways in which what you've seen made you go to things that you do, that make us on that same common level of a desire to recreate what we experience. There's nothing you're studying in your classes that means anything if you don't recreate it and make something of it. You're just given raw materials, all those textbooks and everything, and you're working with them. And for the moment, yes, you're caught up in grades and things like that. That's fine. Do the best you can. Don't worry about whatever you get, because look it, I can't remember what grades I got. I knew so bad, it didn't matter anymore. You're getting your grade in yourself each day. That's the grade that really counts, you see. Thank you for that. Yes, Henry?
I'm wondering if you feel like talking about the new departure that you are embarked on in your books.
Yes. Well, you know, when I was doing my research, I have many African folk tales that I copied out because they're from hundreds of languages, and I work with scholars who translate these oral traditions into words. Well, I, at one point, at an auction, got about 20 slave auctions from 1820s to the 1850s. Sales of property. The property were the people who were the slaves, the hogs, the cattle, the cotton, the jugs, the mills, everything was being for sale. Now, I have these documents, and I've always thought about them. I took out one of the documents of the sale of an estate. This woman is selling, having everything appraised. Her husband has died, and she's going to be leaving the estate. And all of these people are being appraised. Peggy, $150. Marcus, $200. John, $100. Cattle, $400. The gin, the cotton gin, $1,000. All these things are priced as property. I felt I would take this one estate of 11 slaves, create the stories for them. All that's given in the document is their name and the cost. Create the ages and the interrelationships of the slaves on that plantation. That's the project that I'm working with now. It's a challenging project. I see it for young adults and older. All of my books have been for the youngest and up. But this is when I try to get the voice of each slave speaking in the poem that I write, I am sometimes so deeply moved that I'm in tears getting it down. Because I create a life for them, whether they're sometimes apprentices, a carpenter, as a seamstress, it's the cook, it's the one who does all the ironing and washing of clothes. But I've created an interrelationship of these people and a life for them, and they're going to be coming up for sale at auction. And we know at auction very often the men were stripped down, standing up for people to study, and the women, if they had a child, the child would be sold one way, the person, they were always dividing any relationships, any language speaking. When they came over as slaves, they broke up that relationship, so slaves did not have any language but to be forced to learn the English. And so I'm working with this document, which is very challenging, but it's just beginning now. And if ever you come over, you can talk with me about how it's going, because I'm just open now to how it's working. The way I see it for young adults, but because all of my work with my editor has been for the youngest ones, and I had some portraits that I did of three of the slaves, I forgot to tell her it's not a picture book for children. It's a poem for young adults and older. So that's what I'll have to try and see if they will follow that out as a project. So that's, I'm always working on something. So I've been able, by staying home, not doing all my programs, I'm doing a book a year. Last year with the puppets book, I did the poem voices. Before there was Can't Scare Me, The Little Boy Not Afraid of Giants. Before that was Who Built the Stable, The Child Who Builds the Stable, called seeing all those paintings of the holy scene, but never who built that stable. I wrote that stable. Yeah. So, but I'm able, by not traveling as often as I did, instead of several times a month, I'll do five or six a year. But I open to the College of the Atlantic at any time, so you never have to worry about that. I'm always happy to come over and make that exchange with students, as I have through all the years.
Unless they cancel the boat.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes yeah, it's too windy.
The boats there. Yeah, well, we live by a boat schedule.
Do you all, you know, those of us on Islesford have been lucky to see so many of your works in progress, literally in progress.
Yes.
And it's been a great experience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you combine work and play, but I have to say, having watched you with many of your books, you have struggled mightily. This most recent one is the biggest struggle ever, I think. But yeah. you work so hard to come up with what you want to do.
Yes.
I remember when you were doing Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World, I happened to be staying, it was March, there was snow on the street at Islesford. You were walking along the street, you were singing What a Wonderful World under your breath. And I didn't know until a couple of days later why you kept playing that song. And you couldn't come up with the concept, you know, how...
Yes.
I've seen you so many times go through that. Every book
for a year
is a struggle for you.
Yeah,
and
every
the
book.
Play part of it.
I try to get
come
past
in
that.
When you figured out how you can do it. So I just you know, I'd love it if you speak to that, because some people think you're so prolific that you just bounce these things off. And
you know, it develops, because I start out with, who am I? What am I doing? I have no talent. This should be a project for someone else. It's not going to work with you. And I'm trying every way to get out of it, because so now here I'm working to get an eye how I get started. And winter time, I'm lying down, and I don't usually want to take, but I got to take a nap. It's daylight still. And suddenly I'm lying down and say, it's going to start getting dark at 3:30, and it's going to be so much harder to push into an idea as it's getting dark in the day around me. I better get up and try some further. And by getting up and going back, I got a start of how I saw doing the portrait of the slave for sale. I started a portrait. I did a painting. I said, you can't have a pretty painting. I took black line. I drew strong lines on it. Then I took small lines. Then I collaged auctions as the background around it. And I had what I was after, a feeling of a newspaperish look, posted up, and that gave me my lead, how I would like to do the artwork of it. The writing of it is going to be very, very demanding. I've outlined the sense of the relationships of them, but I have to keep building on it. And I will have time, because I will work on it to get it completed by September, October, and then it will come out the following year. The book for coming out in this year is my collage to Langston Hughes' Poems of the Sea. But I'm telling you another thing. Make a note of a book that's coming out in May. If any of you know the artist Marvin Bielek, who did the very popular book, Rain Makes Applesauce, I knew him from 1940 at the Cooper Union. Him and his wife, Emily Nelligan, we were close. We call him Buddy. Buddy worked on a book for over 15 years of a story by Virginia Woolf, the only children's story she had written, Nurse Lupton's Thimble. Editor came into the program and said, I give you one more year. At the end of the year, my friend Buddy refused to hand it in. The editor canceled the contract, took the story from him. There were all these incredible drawings, so fine, so detailed. So I said, listen, Buddy, I'm going to ask my editor if she will work with me in creating a poem, a series of poems, to go with what you tell me about each picture, and we'll create that. And the title is By Trolley Past Thimbledon Bridge, and is being published by my friends of the Alizar Press in Durham, North Carolina. It will be coming out in May, I think, or March or May. And when you see that book, when you look at it first, for the next viewing, get your magnifying glass. And as you look at it and see his little words that he writes around things he make up, that's other than the lines of poetry that I compose for it. It is the most extraordinary. I did not want it to just be in the archive drawings, because at one point his wife got them to the Pierpont Morgan Library, that they would eventually own them. But I was working from 1978, when the editor who worked with me said that the company couldn't do it, I would make the rounds every 4 or 5 years to the major publishers. They all loved his work, but they wouldn't take it on. And I'd go back again and again. And finally, the friends of mine who brought back my book of the spirituals, which were out of print for 40 years, I asked them. And when they saw the print, the pages I had, they said, we'll take it on. Because today, there is what they call a digital process. You know what that means? You can get the close color, everything about it, without touching the paper. So they got the digitals, and they had a master woman who worked with digital. She said sometimes she would magnify a line 15, 20 times, and it looked like it was just an idea. It was so fine. Wait till you see it. My friends are pre-ordering it. It's about $17, $18. It's worth every penny. It's a fantastic book. By Trolley Past Thimbledon Bridge, and it's by words by Ashley Bryan, and the art is Marvin Bielek. Don't miss it! Forget about me. Look for him. Yes, my friend?
I want you to go back to that about the light and dark of how when you are working in the... when it's difficult for you, that you just keep, I'm hearing that you just get in and you stay in the difficult place and you let you're forming this piece of your poetry and you're crying and it's hard, but you're just sticking with it. And then when that something comes out, then you get to go dancing down the street.
Yeah. That way, you'll try different things.
You're not always dancing around. There are these periods where you're just stuck in the mud.
Yeah.
And then you get to...
You'll get it. At sometimes it's something you listen to in music. Sometimes the poem, Eleanor Wiley, you know that wonderful writer, she wrote a poem that's for the snow. Do you know her Velvet Shoes? Oh. Let us walk in the white snow in a soundless space with footsteps quiet and slow at a tranquil pace. Under veils of white lace, I shall go shod in silk, and you in wool, white as a white cow's milk, more beautiful than the breast of a gull. We shall walk through the still town in a windless peace. We shall step upon white down, upon silver fleece, upon softer than these. We shall walk in velvet shoes wherever we go. Silence will fall like dews on white silence below. We shall walk in the snow. Can you imagine anything more restorative than a poem? Oh, grab a poem, you'll get by all right. There's nothing like it.
Ashley, can you talk a little more about your mother and your father? They seemed like such nurturing
Well, I was fortunate. I did have the support and encouragement of family and friends and teachers. So I didn't have people say, oh, you're no good, you can't do this or that, but you have to work against that. I was always encouraged and supported. And my mother was always making our tenement apartment, third or fourth floor, beautiful. And my father was, he was a printer, and he would bring home extra papers from the printing trade. He worked with the Maranos and Bellinis in downtown New York in the 20s, where they did all kinds of fancy deckled edge and cards and things. So they had a sense of making the environment lovely, and that's what I realized from them. Yes, we were third, fourth floor in a tenement apartment, but my parents made the place so beautiful that friends liked to visit. So that has stayed with me, you know. And so when I speak, when people have said, I came up again and again in the letters that the students wrote to me, and I said, never lose that child in you. And one of the statements there was, one of the most tragic experiences in life is the death of a child. So never let that child within you die. And I wanted to make that understood. It's not an easy phrase. I don't mean you had a happy childhood or an unhappy child. That's not what it's saying. It's saying the desire to adventure and learn, it does not matter what the condition of the child. They can be born in a culture where there's very little food, very little clothes, where they're almost out on their own. But that child is struggling. How does one walk? How does one talk? How does one go to the next life? That child is always, no matter what their condition. So don't mistake me. I'm not talking about whether you had a happy childhood or not. I'm talking about that urgency of learning that's in us. And what that involves, the tremendous demands and the suffering it is to, from the crawling, to pull yourself up so you can stand and that you can then take a step. The urgency of growth. And that's why people say, oh, I'm saying about it. No, look. You put a seed in the ground. It's surrounded by dark earth. Tremendous pressure is on it. And it's seeking out any nutrients it can get to begin to push up out of it. You can, all right, it pushes up, it comes up there. From this bulge, my neighbor had these dahlias. And I'm not forgetting the work that that beautiful flower went through in order to be beautiful for me, you see. So when I'm speaking of never lose that child in you, I'm speaking of that urgency, no matter what your experience, of the desire to learn from it so you keep growing. And I take it as the urgency of a seed to come up out of the ground and it becomes a beautiful flower or a plant of an organic food or whatever for you. But there's a tremendous amount of work underneath that brought that about. And I'm speaking of what has been realized, but I don't want you to forget that beneath it is all of that that made it possible to really enjoy it, you see. And if I am projecting happiness, it's at a core of understanding what pain and suffering is in my life as well, you see. So that's what I wanted to get across. Not that you take anything easy and say, oh, child, that's immature. I was told, oh, you got to grow up out of it, as some of the letters said. And, oh, grow up, stop being the child, and get past and forget. No, never forget what it means. What it meant was that each day was going to be an adventure and a discovery. And it didn't matter what your condition, you're going to be urging yourself to make something of it, to learn from it, and to try to survive. Well, there are two hands up. Would you call them?
Yes.
Okay. I will ask. Ashley's, the big inspiration Ashley has been in my life is oral presentation of poetry. And you had said at one point that if music had been treated the way poetry was, that it was just a bunch of black marks on a page, it would have died out thousands of years ago. And I would like you to talk a bit about oral presentation of poetry.
Yes. Well, poetry is at the heart of things. I read a poem to Susie by William Butler Yeats, and after I finished the poem to a friend whose work has come to nothing, he wrote a very moving poem on that theme. And when I read the poem, Susie says, "Does he live on the Cranberry Islands?" But you know, it says, I see if I can remember it. It goes something like this: to a friend whose work has come to nothing, now all the truth is out. Be secret and take defeat from any brazen throat. For how can you, being unabred, compete with one who, were it proved he lies, were neither shamed in his own or in his neighbor's eyes? Bred to a harder truth than triumph, turn away, and like a laughing string with mad fingers play in a place of stone. Be secret and exult, for of all things known, that is most difficult." It's very profound. Whatever you do, you know you. It doesn't matter what anybody is saying about it, but you know the honesty of what you've given to it. So he is saying that when this person has recognized what his work has meant to him, he can take whatever you have to say about it. He will exult, because he's not being cheating. He's not doing something and is not ashamed of it. Because Yeats also wrote, "I made my song a coat woven with embroideries from heel to throat out of old mythologies. But the fools caught it and wore it in the world's eyes as if they had wrought it. Song, let them take it, for there's more enterprise in walking naked." Poetry will do that. Emily Dickinson, what did she say? "There is no frigate like a book to take us lands away, nor any courser like a page of prancing poetry. This traverse may the poorest take without a press of toll. How frugal is the chariot that bears a human soul." I mean, in a few lines, there's no horses prancing like a page of prancing poetry. And she says, "This traverse may the poorest take." You don't need any money. You can get there without having money, without anyone oppressing your toil, and without a press of toll. Oh, can you imagine saying that? If you didn't have poetry, how could you say those words? "This poorest may, this traverse may the poorest take without a press of toll." And then, "How frugal is the chariot that bears a human soul." You know. How frail you are. It's the soul that is the song. It's the soul that sings. And without the soul's song, there's no echoing of song in the person. So through poetry, you can get those words. And I could go on like that. But children, I'm not keeping track of time.
Who's keeping track of time?
Nobody.
Does anybody else have a question? I don't know, John. You usually run these programs. Are we being very...
About 5:30, anytime.
Yeah.
I think 5:30, 6:30, 7:30.
As long as you guys must. And you must be tossing.
Ashley's had a pretty long day.
He's had a long day.
Yeah.
You know, the last time when I closed, there were two poems I did. I did one by Keats. And I said, "This Keats is me. Keats is 25 years old, and he's in Rome. He's dying of tuberculosis. He's dying. He dies at 25, okay? And he writes this poem, and I said, this is me. This is each one of us. And he says, when I have fears that I may cease to be before my pen has gleaned my teeming brain, before high-piled books and charactery hold like garners the rich, ripened grain. When I behold upon the night's starred face huge, cloudy shadows of a high romance and think that I may never live to trace its passage with the magic hand of chance. And when I feel, fair creature of an hour, that I may never look upon thee more, never more have relish in the fairy power of unrequited love, then on the shores of the wide world I stand alone and think, till love and fame to nothingness do sink. Keats was buried in a grave in Rome. And what is his inscription? He would not have his name on the stone. Here lies one whose name was writ on water. He had been so reviled by the critics of his day that Shelley and Byron, who loved and supported him, felt it was the critics who drove that consumption to kill him. But he had no feeling that anything he wrote would last. So here lies one whose name was writ on water. You see. So that tells us a lot, you know, in terms of our yearnings. And to keep, you know, just give the best of yourself.
Very close. Do you just give Things by Eloise Greenfield? Things! By Eloise
Things. Yeah, we'll close with Things, okay? This is the poem I teach all the children, and I tell them, whatever you're doing, that you're doing, when I come to school, I see your artwork, your writing. When there's a birthday, holiday, anniversary, don't go and buy something. Don't say, give me $5 to buy your present. Give one of your writings, of your drawings, a poem you've learned, a song, a dance, whatever. That's the present for the family. So I teach everyone this poem. We all say it together. Things!
Things!
By Eloise Greenfield.
By Eloise Greenfield.
Who went to the corner?
Went to the corner.
Walked in the store.
Walked in the store.
Bought me some candy.
Bought me some candy.
Ain't got it no more.
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 Went to the beach.
Went to the beach.
Played on the shore.
Played on the shore.
Built me a sand house.
Built me a sand house.
Ain't got it no more.
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 Went to the kitchen.
Went to the kitchen.
Lay down on the floor.
Lay down on the floor.
Made me a poem.
Made me a poem.
Still got it.
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 Very nice.